spent some time as well last week. You know? I'm not sure where the interview came up. It probably wasn't really for Johnson. It was probably
no, it's not Johnson himself. It's
somebody picked up.
It's not even a done deal. She's going to be nominated.
Testing. Is this on? Oh, there we go. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming on this afternoon. I think spring has finally arrived in Washington, and we're delighted all of you could spare your afternoon to come and to such an important event to talk about a topic that's not really discussed widely in Washington these days. My name is Glenn Howard. I'm president of the Jamestown Foundation. We have brought to you a distinguished group of people today to talk about the Iskander missile threat to European security. Many of you have followed Russia's developments in its borderlands and also in the periphery of NATO. You're quite familiar with military and security developments, but often you don't hear about the technical systems that are being deployed in these regions. And one of them in particular is the Iskander missile, which has received a lot of discussion in media, but a lot is not widely known about the missile system itself and where it's been deployed, how it's being used, and what is the type of behavior and rationale and thinking behind Putin's moves to deploy the missile system throughout the periphery of the former Soviet Union and also into Kaliningrad, which is next door to Poland. So I think today we've brought to you a great group of people that will be able to describe this development, help educate you more, learn more about the weapon system, what are the various means behind its development, what is exactly its threat. We brought all the way from Poland Dr. Paweł Dorys, who's works at the Polish Ministry of Defense, to share his views about the Iskander system and the perspective from Poland. How does Poland view this? We'll start our talk today by having Jürgen Elfing here, who's from Swedish National Defense University. One of the great things about these contributors today, with the exception of Pavel, is that all of them write for our publication, Eurasia Daily Monitor, which many of you probably read and see in your inbox every day. Jürgen Elfing has been writing about that, sharing Swedish perspectives about the Baltic and in the Eurasia Daily Monitor. He's written a great article about the Gotland Island and what Gotland Island has meant to Swedish security, and he's written about the Iskander. We also have here today Dr. Pavel Baev, who's come all the way from Norway for this event, who is a research professor. He's also a great contributor to the Eurasia Daily Monitor. And Pavel has always been speaking at a lot of Jamestown events. We're just happy that he could be here today. And then last but not least, next in order, is Dr. Paweł Dorys, who's worked for 16 years at the Ministry of Defense and is an expert on international security issues and weapon systems. And last but not least, we have Dr. Stephen Blank. No Jamestown event would be complete without having Steve present and discussing his views. And I think that we have a great appreciation for Steve, and who's another person who writes regularly for Eurasia Daily Monitor. So all these different presentations today are going to offer you different perspectives. So I'd like to point out to you that there is a handout that Jürgen will be using as his first briefing. Unfortunately, we don't have the slides on the screen, but you have the handout. If you don't have it, my staff will bring it to you. So we're going to start off with having Pavel give his... with Jürgen and his presentation, and who's come here all the way from Sweden just for this event. So he'll be talking about the operational threat of the Iskanders to European security. Once we're finished with the discussion today, we will have questions and answers. I just ask you to put your cell phones on mute. So, thank you. Jürgen,
thank you.
The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. You have got a handout of the slides that I've prepared for this briefing. Please follow those slides. I think we'll get it all right. The first slide is a Russian cartoon, which very well describes what it's all about. The Russians, they see Iskanders as a way of giving NATO an adequate answer to NATO's activities in Eastern Europe. And what are we talking about? We are talking about a missile system called Iskander or SS-26 Stone. As you can see on the second slide, the system comprises only two types of missiles, one ballistic missile and one cruise missile. The range for both those missiles is about 500 kilometers, but a couple of Russian sources, they have mentioned a range of about 900 kilometers, and there is even a Russian source mentioning a range of 2,000 kilometers, and I think they refer to the cruise missile. As you can see, both types of missile, they have a very high degree of precision, with a CAP of a few meters for the cruise missile, and 5 to 7 meters for the ballistic missile. And also the ballistic missile has an impressive range of different warheads, including nuclear, the possibility to equip it with nuclear warheads. These missiles are used for different targets. The cruise missile is used against the point targets, and the ballistic missile is employed against targets that are exposed on a larger area. And these two missiles is not just the only thing in the system. As you see, you can see in the lower part of the slide, there are a number of other functions, command and control vehicles, etc., etc. And altogether, these missiles and the other components, they are organized in missile brigades. And if you go to the next slide, you will find those missile brigades that I have been able to identify from open Russian sources. And all brigades are subordinated to an army, with one exception. And that is the 152nd Missile Brigade in Kaliningrad Oblast. It is subordinated to the 11th Army Corps, a recently organized staff. And there is also another thing that is a little odd. Among all those brigades, you will find a missile battalion, and that is that battalion is garrisoned in Kapustin Yar. And my assessment is that that battalion is helping with re-equipping the missile brigades. All brigades, with the exception of the brigade in Kaliningrad Oblast, are equipped with Iskanders. And the 119th Brigade and the 20th Brigade, those were the last brigades to be re-equipped with Iskanders. The brigade in Kaliningrad Oblast is equipped with an older type of missile, SS-21 Tochka, which has a much shorter range. How do the Russians do when they re-equip these missile brigades? Well, first of all, the Russian arms industry produces 2 brigade systems every year. And that means that they can re-equip 2 brigades every year. And that has been standard operating procedure the last few years. How many brigades are there to re-equip? Well, I mentioned the brigade in Kaliningrad Oblast, but Russia has recently organized 2 new armies. One, the 1st Guards Tank Army in the Western Military District, and the 8th Army in the Southern Military District. At the moment, I have not identified a missile brigade within those 2 armies, but I do not exclude the possibility that they will be, that we will find such a brigade within those 2 armies. And the Russians have said that the re-equipment of the missile brigades will be accomplished before 2020, and that fits with 3 remaining brigades, 2 being re-equipped today, this year, and 1 in 2018. So we will see what will happen. And what is important is that the infrastructure is in place prior to the re-equipment. The Minister of Defense, he has pointed out that this is a precondition. We need to have the storage in place before we hand over the new equipment. That has not always been the case. Not some of the brigades that received the Iskanders as the earliest the earlier brigade, they had to store their missiles in the open air. The actual re-equipment is accomplished in Kapustin Yar, which means that the missile brigade that is to be given an Iskander is relocated to Kapustin Yar, is trained on the new equipment, and they are also firing a number of missiles, and thereafter they are giving the new missiles in a formal ceremony before they go back to their ordinary garrison. And as you can see on the picture on the slide, you have two satellite images from over Kaliningrad Oblast, where the 152nd Brigade is located. And you can see that there have been some changes between 2012 and 2014. And this indicates that they are doing something in that area, probably related to storage areas for new missiles. And there are even more recent satellite images showing construction going on in this area. When we are talking about Kaliningrad Oblast, from time to time the Russians have mentioned the possibility of deploying Iskanders to Kaliningrad Oblast. And this started in 2008 when the then President Medvedev mentioned this possibility. And that was probably caused by the fact that at the time the Russian General Staff had developed plans for deploying missiles in Kaliningrad Oblast. From time to time they have deployed missiles to Kaliningrad Oblast. Last time in October 2016. And the funny thing is that when they deploy the missiles to Kaliningrad Oblast, that gets a lot of attention. But when they bring back the missiles to Russia proper, that is not the case. And in October last year, when they loaded the missiles in the inner part of the Gulf of Finland, the Russian claimed that the loading was observed by a US reconnaissance satellite. But that's also a way to get attention. Those missiles that have occurred in Kaliningrad Oblast, they are coming from the missile brigade in Luga. And today there are indications suggesting that the brigade in Chernyshovsk will get Iskanders in 2017, that is this year. If you look at this slide with a map of the Baltic Sea region, you see the range of Iskander. And on that slide, I have highlighted air bases, naval bases, and air bases. This shows that the Russians have a wide range of possible targets, although not all garrisons or not all bases are on that slide. And that brings us to how we should look upon the threat. The threat has many dimensions. First of all, if the Russians state that they will deploy missiles to Kaliningrad Oblast, or we perceive that they are thinking of doing it, then we have the actual deployment of the missiles in Kaliningrad Oblast or otherwise, then the threat is in place, and if they use the missiles, the threat gets another dimension. And the missiles, they can be targeting both civilian and military targets, and they can use both conventional and nuclear warheads. So when you're looking at the threat, it's not just the Iskander in itself. You have to look upon when they are deployed, etc., etc. And that leads to my conclusions that the Iskanders, they are both a kinetic and a psychological weapon. And the psychological weapon can be used today by hinting that we will deploy missiles to Kaliningrad, for example. and saying that, okay, we will not deploy the missiles if you don't, and so on. And that means that the likely targets for these missiles are military and civilian targets. It will be high value assets, well defended assets, because it's less costly to use an Iskander missile than using air power. And another target is also hearts and minds. And that is hearts and minds of the politicians in the area, but also the hearts and minds of the public. And one problem connected with the Iskander is that the modern society tends to put all the eggs in the one and same basket. That means, how is it with our redundancy? How many power stations do we have? How many logistical bases do we have? What happens if we just have one logistical base and it is hit by Iskander? And if there is a crisis in the Baltic Sea region, if we are going to reinforce the Baltic states, that will become a risky business if we have Iskanders in the area. And we have also to consider the nuclear aspect, because from time to time, the Russians are writing about the idea they have to use tactical nuclear weapons in order to de-escalate the conflict. But the number of missiles is not unlimited. And you could also discuss the possibility to reinforce Kaliningrad Oblast with missiles in time of crisis. And Kaliningrad Oblast is also a rather limited piece of a state. So if there are Iskanders in that area in time of crisis, I think it would be rather easy to find, fix, and hopefully destroy those missiles. But probably not with air power. It has to be done with ground forces. That sounds my briefing.
Thank you. Paul?
Yes?
You're next. So tell us what it means for European security.
All right. Of course.
Missile card.
Of course. I think it is very useful once in a while to have a conference with a very specific, precise topic. Not just the world peace and how to get there, but something very clear, and I hope Jürgen really presented us with all the parameters of the problems very clearly. And my task would be the opposite, to show that the clarity we have with this topic is not really complete, that we have in fact a lot of issues to ponder here. And for instance, asking, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a ballistic missile of 500 kilometer range, or about a cruise missile double the range, or about a new cruise missile of 2,000 kilometers range? Are we generally talking about military balance or operational targets, or are we talking arms control? Are we talking about US-Russia relations primarily? Or are we talking?
No, it's the vote.
It's about
us. Or are we talking about
democracy in action?
Russia relations with NATO? Are we talking about the Baltic theater primarily? Or are we talking about the Caucasus and the Far East and Syria? And the answers to all the to each of these questions is both. We need to talk all of these matters, and that creates, instead of clarity, a lot of ambiguity, a lot of complexity in the topic, and generally ambiguity works very well for Russia. That's really what Putin enjoys, which he is really trying to create in every possible situation, because it then becomes very difficult to decide how to respond, what is the right course of action, and kind of, if there is no clear response, ambiguity increases, and kind of, it's possible to portray the West as undecisive, not able to formulate a countermeasure. And I don't think it was really planned this way with this particular missile. I think originally Russian constructors were inspired by US design of a vertical launcher on the ships, which can really launch about any type of missile. And they said, it's a great idea, we will probably not do that for our ships, but as far as can our land missile is concerned, this Iskander launcher, we can experiment with that and see what can be done with it, what can be launched from the same machine. And I think they succeeded in that. And they were not really thinking in arms control terms that once you test from that launcher a cruise missile with a range of 2,000 kilometers, then all the launchers of this kind are becoming in violation of the INF Treaty. It's not really how the weapon designers think, it's how the strategists should think, and they probably went. So what happens now is a kind of net value added in terms of ambiguity, in terms of complexity of the matter, which, as I said, works for Russia very well. In order to navigate through that ambiguity, I have several theses, several propositions to advance, all of them very problematic, and Steve, for that matter, will be easily able to destroy each and every of them. But nevertheless, just to kind of, to get some feeling where might the depth of this, of the problem with this missile be. And my first point is that we should really discuss the Iskander missile together with the problem of INF Treaty. And it's not by chance that they develop these two problems in parallel. Russian violation of an INF treaty and the risk presented by the deployment of Iskanders. In principle, as far as Russia is concerned, the motivation for deploying this kind of missile and that kind of missile is about the same. The targets for them are there to hit because Russia cannot, unlike the West, rely on long-range strike drones, and it doesn't have really complete trust in its own tactical aviation, because in principle all the targets for the Iskander missiles that that there are can be hit otherwise with these two weapon systems, and Russia has no capabilities for hitting that target. That's why the need in the missile of that range and of this range, it's essentially the same. The same need, and kind of that's why the missiles become two sides of the same coin. Even if sometimes politically it is better to separate them. My second proposition is that Russia will not withdraw from the INF Treaty, and that Russia will not comply. Russia will remain in that gray area in between, sort of challenging the United States to withdraw from the treaty, denying its own violations, trying to increase the ambiguity around this probably last remaining piece of the massive arms control arrangements that, that we had, that kind of remnant of the glory, days of glory, when one treaty was coming after another, and then they were kind of collapsing one after another. INF we still do have. It's a treaty signed in the year 87 by Mikhail Gorbachev and kind of Ronald Reagan. Generally a breakthrough of its time. And abandoning it completely probably will not suit Russia's interest because of all sort of collateral damage associated with this sort of behavior. Even if Russia had broken before many treaties and initiatives, it's probably for Russia works far better to try to provoke United States to make this step. And my kind of next proposition is that for United States, it will not be possible, as Obama administration desperately tried, to push Russia to, or to pull Russia back into compliance with the INF Treaty, to persuade and convince that it works far better to kind of return to maintain this arrangement. And this push and pull strategy is essentially bilateral. That is US-Russia relations. You know, that is the dialogue on the highest level and lower. What we are going to deal with this situation of neither here nor there, of the gray zone, is not a bilateral situation. It is a problem for a wider context. It, first of all, it is a problem for European NATO states. And they so far have remained rather silent on the INF treaty problem, primarily because they are not sufficiently informed what are really the violations, what is the problem with that treaty. They are concerned about the Iskander, and again, that problem is oscillating. Now they are in Kaliningrad, now they are not. But you know, fundamentally, the way to deal with this situation of ambiguity, where Russia is in violation but in denial at the same time, is through mobilizing as far as possible the whole NATO strength, and that's what Stephen Pfeiffer argues today in one of his articles. We need to internationalize this problem. It cannot be dealt on the one-by-one level, even if that is always the preferred format. My next thesis is proposition is that there is no need to respond in kind. Yes, Russia is deploying these missiles and probably missiles of a longer range, but we're not stepping back into the situation of late 70s when NATO response to Russia SS-20 missiles was a deployment of Pershing and ground-based cruise missiles. There is no need really to reproduce that crisis, which was in fact very painful inside the alliance, not only between the alliance in Russia, because there are other weapon systems, there are other ways to respond to this Russian behavior. First of all, by strengthening the monitoring, by getting a better picture of what Russia really is doing, by investing in intelligence of various kinds. Secondly, by investing in air and missile defense. There is no kind of the missile defense doesn't really work against cruise missiles. You know, that's the technicality of the matter. It is essentially the air defense plus the information gathering that works against that threat. And the that part of the response is generally far less problematic than responding in kind, which is usually and normally kind of the most basic instinct in for military planners. You have that weapon, we have kind of the same kind and even more and even stronger. Asymmetrical responses, I think, would work far better in this situation, particularly since these responses will not go into violation of any international agreement and arrangements. My next proposition is that it is possible to separate the missile problem from the nuclear problem. And yes, the Iskander missile is nuclear capable, and yes, the missiles which are tested are also nuclear capable, but we don't have any signs so far that this capability, the potentiality, is really becoming an issue. In Russia, all non-strategic nuclear weapons remain in a kind of black box, and not only because there is no information about how many warheads are there in that black box, but because there is no field manuals about how to use them, there is no training of troops how to use them, there is no experiments with deploying and equipping missiles for them. Possessing these warheads is one thing, really turning them into a usable weapon is a different story. And separating the missile problem from the nuclear problem, I think, also would work far better for the NATO solidarity. There is very strong anti-nuclear sentiments in many of the European countries. The moment you start mixing this thing up, all sort of inadequate responses might come up. It is, again, some might look artificial what we're dealing about here, but I think it may be very useful. to say missiles and that part of the problem, and there are kind of large and nuclear-related problems, including the strategic nuclear weapons, how they are separated from the non-strategic weapons. That is would be a separate story. My next thesis is that China cannot be constructively brought into this problem. Each time you mention China in every context, it sounds interesting. Yes, China certainly must be a part of this problem, and for Russia it is. And for the United States in some ways it is also. But I don't really see any signs from the side of China that they are interested in any possible way in discussing arms control matters, in joining that process. It is a completely negative attitude, and I don't see that changing. So China is certainly present in every global equation, in every global military balance, but I don't see how cooperation with China, dialogue with China on these matters can be advanced. Again, I may be wrong on that. We probably need more experts with specific China angles. Looking from angle of Russia-China relations, I cannot really see any prospect for bringing that matter here. My final thesis, which is number 7, in fact, is that it is probably possible to have a separate conversation about Kaliningrad. That is a very peculiar, very particular point in the whole European security system, where Russia has assets and vulnerabilities, where Russia feels it can play up the assets at the same time feeling very uncertain about how Kaliningrad is vulnerable to blockades, to surprise actions from NATO, being isolated, far isolated. And again, Iskanders and missiles are really a part of that conversation, because Russia really cannot ensure the security of that enclave without missiles deployed there, and they are not deployed there so far, as we have just heard. Although Russia kind of tried and planned and see how it works, what sort of responses they are. So it is probably useful for NATO to try this very special narrow avenue for dialogue with Russia about that very special bastion in the Russian defenses. And here comes my bottom line, probably about time. What I want to say in the bottom line is certainly all of these propositions are problematic, and whether on this hill, in the White House, there is really readiness at the moment to deal with them, with this problem, and to address the challenge, and to kind of to take up the tests which are set by Russia, well, I do have my grave doubts, and I prepare to swallow them. What I can see about the Kremlin's side of the whole problem is that you look at all those narrow circles around Putin. Some of them are very much reshuffled recently, and some of them are remain very stable. And you don't really find in any of them people who think in strategic terms, who understand missiles, who are schooled in the classes of deterrence. There are all sort of people around there with views on various matters. There is very little understanding of strategic deterrence on various levels, including on this one. Much the same, surprisingly, can be said probably about the Ministry of Defense and the General Staff. Most of the people who are advanced under Shoigu, and he himself, are really thinking very much about different matters other than nuclear and strategic and missiles. They are much preoccupied with physical problems of power projections of a different kind. Very little particular expertise there. So the whole conversation about missiles with Russia is not strategic, is not in deterrence term, it is political. It is a political conversation which Putin understands perfectly well. And the topic, the theme for this conversation is that, yes, there is ambiguity and uncertainty, but it doesn't mean confusion in the West. Ambiguity is recognized as a risk. The problem with missile is assessed thoroughly. There is no confusion. There is full preparedness to work together for addressing this risk. There is no chance for Russia to benefit from the ambiguity and to score because of the confusion. Thank you very much. That's my take on the problem.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was a really very, very good presentation. Really appreciate your insight on that issue, and especially the part about the Putin's advisors and not knowing strategic deterrence issues. I'm not sure if Steve agrees or not, but we'll soon hear. Our next speaker will be Dr. Pavel Durish. We'll be talking to Standard Threat to European Security. Come all the way from Warsaw, Poland. We appreciate you making the trip for this event.
Yes.
That means the nuclear button has been hit. So.
Either that or Putin is calling for Pavel.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for your kind words, ladies and gentlemen. I will try to focus my brief on four issues. First, I will start with the broader context, including Russia's assessment of threats, rules for use of nuclear weapons and military activities. The second will be Iskander missile threat per se. The third one is Russia's valuation of the INF Treaty. And then I will try to say a few words on strategic consequences and challenges for NATO, as well as new approaches. Let's start with the broader context. After 2014, it's clear that there are serious differences in the Allies and Russian approaches to Euro-Atlantic security. This is due to the asymmetry in their national security interests and their military potential. This also refers to the destabilizing factors such as ballistic missile defense, non-strategic nuclear weapons, conventional prompt global strike, and other high precision conventional weapons. Russia is unlikely to agree to any further reductions in nuclear weapons so long as the United States is intent on building up its strategic ballistic missile defense. However, expecting Washington to give up this BMD project is not realistic. At the same, the United States and European allies will seek to limit non-strategic nuclear forces, an area in which Russia boasts quantitative superiority. But Moscow will not agree to talks on this issue unless they include high-precision conventional weapons and disparities between Russia and NATO in conventional armed forces. Subject of our today's discussion, Iskander missile threat is a key component of above-mentioned destabilizing factors to Euro-Atlantic security. In its military doctrine, Russia has identified NATO as a main external military danger. Russia also sees US policy as a potential military threat to its security. At the moment, only the US has the capacity to neutralize Russia's nuclear forces, its early warning systems, and space control assets. Russia reserves the right to use nuclear weapons in response to an attack against it or its allies involving weapons of mass destruction, and also in the event of aggression of a conventional nature and situation presenting a threat to the state's existence. By providing for a first strike use, Russia has based its security policy on the deterrent function of nuclear weapons, including both strategic and tactical nuclear weapons. The assumed main role of Russian TNW is to balance NATO and China's superiority in conventional arms. Russian authorities haven't revealed information about either size of this arsenal or its role in the defense planning. According to the de-escalation doctrine, the detonation of a small number of TNW warheads would demonstrate Russia's readiness to use all available means to protect itself and its interests. At the same time, the limited extent of damage to an enemy would prevent the escalation of the war to the strategic level. Consequently, it's reasonable to assume that the use of TNW would be also exercised by missile forces. The use of Iskander nuclear-capable tactical ballistic missiles has been simulated during the Zapad series military exercises. Russia feels also free to increase the amount of conventional military equipment in the European part of the state. Aiming to maintain its sphere of influence in the post-Soviet area and be recognized as a world power, Russia has increasingly based its foreign policy on military activities. The scenarios in the exercises show that Russia not only seeks to defend its territory, but also conduct military operations on a limited scale in order to gain control of areas beyond Russia. The increased intensity of the Russian routine exercises since 2014, with high-precision strikes conducted by joint forces, including missile components from the Western Military District, also indicates that the exercises are not only verifying combat readiness, but also seeking to exert pressure on neighboring states and create divisions among NATO states. These exercises serve as a reminder to external observers that the Russian doctrine envisions the use of non-strategic nuclear weapons in certain scenarios of a conflict with NATO forces. The Iskander missile threat is very high on the security and defense policy agenda nowadays. It has been a topic loudly discussed on both sides of the Atlantic for years, which draws attention of the public opinion, military experts, and decision makers. Today, given the recent worrisome changes in the Euro-Atlantic security environment caused by Russia's provocative behavior and aggressive actions, it's even more important. The ballistic and cruise missile threats from Russia to NATO Europe are real and constantly growing. It's also of paramount importance that the Iskander missile threats to NATO Europe originate from various directions, from Kaliningrad Oblast, from Crimea, and even from Syria, and successively grow due to the Russia's rearmament and modernization plans. As it was mentioned by my Swedish colleague, in recent years, Russia has continued process of re-equipment of all missile brigades with a new Iskander ballistic missiles and Iskander cruise missiles. This process is expected to be completed by the end of 2018. So far, Iskander missiles have been sent to 7 out of the 10 missile brigades. Therefore, Iskander missiles are well-balanced and cost-effective military tool for Russia, creating new security situation in terms of nuclear and missile threats to European security. In this regard, most allies see the recent deployment of the highly mobile, nuclear-capable Iskander missiles to Kaliningrad enclave as a provocative and unnecessary step, which is aimed at destabilizing the security environment in Europe. Poland and Baltic states take into account that Iskander missile, with highly accurate guidance systems that can place warhead in intended target, makes Russia capable of striking almost their entire territories, including high-value assets such as airfields, seaports, and C2 centers. Even if Iskander missiles are not permanently based in the Kaliningrad Oblast, they might be transported there very quickly by air or sea. It was exercised by Russia a couple of times. It puts the whole region under direct threat of conventional or nuclear ballistic missile attack. The presence of S-300 and S-400 air and missile defense systems gives Russia the capability to enforce no-fly zones as a part of A2AD concept and secure dominance in the air over large areas of the Baltic Sea, in Baltic states and Poland, also limiting NATO's ability to defend the region. In particular, the anti-access area denial capabilities require our attention. Russia has developed its A2AD capabilities, which are able to cover a significant part of the alliance territory. Those systems could hamper NATO freedom of movement if such need arises. It puts into question the long-lasting NATO's philosophy of supporting its eastern members for reinforcement. These capabilities are an integral part of Russian political and military strategy that multiplies their ability to launch a large-scale attack. The deployment of such sophisticated and difficult to detect and to fight offensive weaponry in the direct neighborhood of NATO borders should be taken into account in alliance's defense planning. Therefore, NATO and its allies should develop full spectrum of capabilities to defend ourselves against these existential and difficult to tackle threats. Those capabilities should include active defense against ballistic and cruise missiles, such as robust and effective missile defense systems, jamming and electronic warfare assets, and counterforce capabilities to prevent missiles from being launched, such as precision-guided weapons. When developing the answer to the Iskander missile threat, one needs to think ahead of time and take into account not only the current challenges, but also the ones that may pop up in the near future. It mainly relates to Russia's violation of the INF Treaty. The INF Treaty is a unique Cold War disarmament agreement that banned an entire category of US and Soviet Union arms, ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles with range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. By reducing the risk of an out-of-the-blue nuclear attack, the treaty has become one of the cornerstones of military stability and predictability in Europe. From our perspective, it also eliminates the coupling of US and allied security. Therefore, any information on Russia's violation of the INF Treaty raises our serious concerns. Since 2008, the US has stressed many times that Russia violates its obligations not to possess, produce, or flight test a ground launch cruise missile with a prohibited range, or to possess or produce launchers for such missiles. According to the latest statement made by Vice Chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff General Paul Selva, Russia has deployed a land-based SSC-X-8 cruise missile that violates the spirit and intent of INF Treaty. It uses the same launcher as the Iskander ballistic missiles. It's estimated that it may have a range between 500 and 5,500 kilometers and can carry both conventional and nuclear payloads. There is also speculation that it could be a possible successor missile ground launch version of the Sea Launch Calibre NK missile, which poses a comparable challenge to NATO's SSC-X-8 missile. The other missile that creates concern is the currently deployed Iskander-M. Even though its official range is less than 500 kilometers, its technical parameters indicate that it can reach targets at greater distances. US diplomatic efforts to convince Russia to return to full and verifiable compliance under the treaty have not brought up to now the desired effects. Russia consistently denies the US charges and accuses the US of breaching the treaty. It's likely that Russia covertly deploys the cruise missile without formally abandoning the INF Treaty. Violation of the INF Treaty has crucial impact on European and transatlantic security. It clearly demonstrates that Russia strives to acquire diverse and tested options for a missile strike against Europe and US forces in Europe. The direct missile threat to different European states would depend on the number, range, and deployment location of missiles. For example, deployment of 3,000 kilometer range missiles in Western Military District would allow Russia to deliver nuclear or conventional strikes on all European NATO members except some part of Iceland and Portugal. A diversified missile arsenal broadens Russia's options for intimidating Europe. In a hypothetical confrontation with a NATO ally, test of nuclear-capable missiles or the use for limited conventional strikes can signal a growing risk of nuclear escalation. It could, for example, be exploited in a scenario in which Russia creates a fait accompli in Central Europe and tries to deter other allies from sending reinforcements. Apart from such the intimidation and deterrence value, Russia may also use its missiles as an effective warfighting tool. This applies to the conventionally armed missiles, as the threshold for using them is lower than for nuclear armed weapons. Last but not least, Russia's missiles can be seen as a countermeasure to US NATO BMD installations in Europe. In this regard, allies should continue efforts to develop effective NATO integrated air and missile defense systems, providing a significant level of defense against full spectrum of ballistic and cruise missiles, and at the same time adding to collective defense and deterrence capabilities. We see this system as a significant part of the military answer to complex missile threats coming from Russia. It should refer to both their intensity and complexity. A few words on the strategic consequences and challenges for NATO. Apart from its military implications, the INF Treaty violation is also the final stage in Russia's dismantling military predictability in Europe. It would highly increase threats to security and stability, in particular to the threat of short warning attack on targets of strategic importance. Preservation of the viability of the INF Treaty is crucial to avoid the coupling of US and allied security, as well as keeping the same security level between NATO, Europe and US territories. INF Treaty is also very important because it enhances credibility of US security guarantees for European allies. Therefore, there is a need for a firm US response in close consultation with NATO allies. In this context, US should focus on resolving all concerns through dialogue with Russia, including the Special Verification Commission established by the INF Treaty. At the same time, NATO should consult on a specific set of different military measures to tailor its deterrence and defense posture in case Russia gradually deploys missiles incompatible with the INF Treaty. That fact should then be publicized to strengthen NATO strategic communication in this field and clearly reflect the alliance's willingness to risk the political, financial, and military cost of a response to INF Treaty breach. We should be fully aware that this process of finding an appropriate response would be complicated by reaching a consensus among NATO allies. In addition, the modalities of NATO and EU's response would depend on the scale of Russia's actions and NATO's readiness to make and implement relevant decisions. For Poland, the growing Iskander missile threat and violation of INF Treaty shows the important role of NATO nuclear deterrence policy, including the presence of US nuclear weapons in Europe, as well as significance of greater military presence in our territory of Allied forces. The predictable future of the INF Treaty confirms that the modernization of Polish armed forces should include reliable defensive and dissuasive capabilities. The US, including US Congress, have an important role in this effort. It seems that in the 21st century, the arms control mechanism created during the Cold War based on legally binding agreements is far from applicable when it comes to the possible regulation of numerous components that destabilize today's security environment at both a bilateral and multilateral level. There is a clear need to develop new instruments to regulate these areas and supplement pre-existing legally binding agreements. Supporting and strengthening the Euro-Atlantic stability is a process that should ensure the situation remains predictable, while also preventing an escalation of political military crisis and ruling out unnecessary arms race expenditures. These instruments could include confidence-building measures and enhanced transparency regarding particularly sensitive components of military tools. It's particularly important to be aware that the Euro-Atlantic security will be increasingly influenced by the need to avoid the development of an offensive land-based ballistic and cruise missile systems. Strategic stability in the world and the situation in particular relating to European security for the coming years will depend directly on whether Russia and the United States, together with other NATO member states, are able to ensure predictability on the offensive missile issue. The system has to be based on an operational cooperation mechanism, including preserved INF treaty. This requires considerable political will from all sides. Concluding my brief, I would like to stress that Poland is a strong advocate of developing robust and effective response to Russian missile threat in Europe as a part of wider build-up of A2AD zones and offensive military strategy and doctrine. Given the existential nature of this threat and the coupling risk in NATO, the Euro-Atlantic community cannot just live with it. We need to take actions to fight this challenge. This approach shall be generally shared by all allies. Thank you for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay.
First, I'd like to thank Glenn for inviting me and for the kind words he said. The check is in the mail. Second, I come neither to bury Pavel nor to praise him. I'm rather going to talk about some of the strategic consequences of the Iskander deployment in general, and then with particular focus on the southern tier, that is Ukraine, Black Sea, Caucasus, Middle East. And here again, the quote is applicable: the evil that Putin does lives long after him, the good might be interred with his bones. It certainly is true that the deployment of the Iskander, as you've heard, creates significant and important difficult threats to Northern Europe and to NATO in general. There is a tendency, however, to overlook the equally critical implications of these deployments for the areas south of Belarus, Ukraine, Black Sea, Caucasus, and Middle East, because the deployment of the Iskander is taking place in these areas as well. If you look at the map that was made available to you, you will see that there is a series of what professionals are calling bubbles, anti-access area defense, A2AD, deployments within which not only the Iskander, but anti-air and anti-ship missiles have been deployed all across Russia. Now, if you take into account the fact that we have a deployment from the Baltic Sea all the way down to the Middle East in Syria, and the fact that Iskanders have been moved into all those areas, what we see is, first of all, a strategy, whether it was intended or not, it certainly has had that consequence, of creating an A2AD type operation or formation across the entire Russian perimeter. Now in the Arctic, we are beginning to see something like this come into being, although Iskanders are not in the Arctic. But we certainly have always seen the anti-air and anti-ship capability to protect the SLBMs based at Severodvinsk and Murmansk. But what's perhaps more sinister is the fact that this is now being extended into the Middle East, into Syria, which has the important point of trying to deny NATO access not only to the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East, but to the Caucasus, to Ukraine, and the entire Black Sea littoral. And if you look at conventional deployments of the Russian military in the last year or two, you will see as well that most of the deployments, despite the really grave threats facing the Baltic, have been to the south with the ground forces. Jürgen mentioned the 8th Army. It's a brand new army. It's against Ukraine. But it can easily be targeted on the Caucasus, for example, or deployed to the Middle East because its headquarters is Rostov-na-Don. So it's easily accessible. And what we also see in conjunction with the deployment of the Iskander, the anti-ship ground forces, electronic capabilities, and so on, is a new emphasis just announced 2 weeks ago on amphibious capability, sea lift, the ability to move troops by sea from point A to point B, which again, we've seen this in Georgia in 2008. We could see it again if there's another Caucasus contingency, and we've seen it in the Middle East. Add to that the fact that Russia is attempting to create a network of bases in the Middle East. Syria, Cyprus, Egypt, Libya, and probably in Iran, once again, you begin to see that the threat that the Russian military poses is not just NATO, it is the Caucasus, and even US forces or pro-US forces in the Middle East. If you can put Iskanders into Syria, and you have a base in Syria, as the Russians do, and you will possibly have one in Iran, as is quite likely, you then have some ability to deter the Fifth Fleet in the Gulf. We're not even talking about a European scenario. You have a capability to threaten that far away. Add to that overall conventional strategy, protecting the perimeter and then having the ability to project power and push the threat perceived by Moscow back, is the whole question of nuclear escalation, which is connected with the INF Treaty and with the deployment of the Iskander. Now, it is an article of faith in many quarters that the Russian nuclear strategy is escalated to the escalate, that if a war breaks out, of course, from the Russian point of view, it will be awful, but they will likely be the aggressors. If a war breaks out and Russia's in danger of losing, it is likely to escalate, probably with tactical nuclear weapons, or perhaps something like the Iskander and its nuclear guys, in order to force the Allies to de-escalate and return to some sort of status quo ante or to a negotiation. And thus it's a strategy of intra-war escalation. I would argue that the deployment of the Iskanders in their nuclear and even their conventional form, plus the deployment of the SSCM-8, which is the weapon that violates the INF, as well as the other nuclear weapons, and Putin's willingness to invoke the nuclear threat, whether by overflights, submarine probes, or rhetorical, are part of a broader strategy de facto, which subsumes escalate to de-escalate within it, and which is really a strategy of controlling escalation from the beginning of a crisis till the end. It is not intra-war escalation control, but crisis management throughout the period, and it includes the possibility, if things get out of hand, of escalating to de-escalate. Much broader, much more dangerous, and much more coterminous, if you like, with the strategy of information warfare that I think Jürgen or Pavel mentioned, of using this to impress upon European audiences, I'm willing to go nuclear, and you can't stop me, and you know what's going to happen if I do. Because it's a strategy to inhibit NATO from acting.
It's a strategy, as Pavel just talked about, for limited warfare. A fait accompli. Present the allies with a fait accompli. The nuclear threat prevents them from acting, and we get now something new coming in as well. NATO has begun to reply in the last 12 to 18 months. We've seen an influx and an acceleration of NATO defense spending, defense deployments, and so on. Regardless of the rhetoric of this administration, troops and equipment are now flowing to Europe. Maybe not enough, but much faster than was the case before. We see the new deployments on the Russian side, creation of divisions rather than brigades, creation of armies rather than brigades, out of those divisions. Their deployment, particularly around Ukraine and the Black Sea and near the Caucasus, as signs that Russia may be thinking that it may no longer be able to mount a fait accompli. What has happened to it in Ukraine also makes it difficult for a Russian general staff planner to imagine that it would be that simple once again to seize territory or advance. And that therefore they are thinking in terms of at least of a contingency of prolonged or protracted conflict with NATO. Now finally, in the general sense, let me direct your attention to an interview with Fiona Hill, who is supposed to be nominated to be the Russia person at the NSC. It's in Johnson's Russia list today, where Fiona says, and I think quite rightly, we're not in a cold war with Russia. We're in a hot war. Now, that does not mean people are shooting at each other yet. But it does mean, except in Ukraine, but it does mean that we are in a protracted state of conflict. You look at the information warfare that has happened here, and that is still happening and occurring all over Europe, and we see this. Take all those things into account, and then let's focus on one particular area where the Iskander plays an increasing role, and that is in the Caucasus. I've already outlined to you the idea of projection of power, isolation of the perimeter of the Russian heartland from NATO, and so on. Starting in September, Russia deployed Iskander missiles in Armenia at its base in Gyumri. According to the Armenian authorities, not only is Armenia the first foreign country to receive the Iskander, which already itself, the idea of transferring these to a foreign government, indicates some form of escalation or advance in Russian practice. The Iskander M, which they claim they received, is completely under Armenian control. And now, I don't believe that, but that's a dangerous thing to say because it means that Armenians believe, or at least think they can figure out a way to use this weapon without having to answer to anybody in doing so. And that Russia has, therefore, no technical capability to block its operation. Again, I don't believe that. I think it's a rhetorical attempt to frighten Azerbaijan and everybody else, but this could also be used against Georgia as well. It indicates the danger that will break out if there's another conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh or another Georgian war, and we should note that Russia is continuing to advance in the Caucasus as well as in Ukraine by, for example, incorporating the South Ossetian, quote, army into the Russian army. Sooner or later, the whole state will go with it. As a matter of fact, the Armenian first deputy defense minister said that the range of the Iskander M is enough to hit critical objects in Azerbaijan, and that the defense minister said it could cause irreparable damage to infrastructure, and that Russia is responsible for giving it to us because we don't have the ability to make it. Russia fulfills its allied obligations, and that's an important term, allied obligations, in terms of our military hardware, because it says that Russia and Armenia are allies, which they are under the CSTO, but Azerbaijan is a member as well. Yeah. Of CSTO? Yeah. No? Okay. So, it's even more, my mistake, then I stand corrected, but as Armenia is, and that gives you an idea of what's at stake in the Caucasus. It also indicates some of the absurdity of this conflict because when Azerbaijan buys weapons from the Russians, it pays full price. Armenia gets a discount. In effect, Baku is subsidizing Yerevan, even as Yerevan and Baku are fighting a war, or at least on two sides of a very shaky truce. Furthermore, Russia and Armenia have now established a joint air defense in the Caucasus, and we know from experience that air defense is the prerequisite for the further military integration of Armenian forces into Russian or with Russian forces and the expansion of Russian deployments in the Caucasus, which are already naval and air and ground forces. And they also created joint forces, quote, to ensure security in the Caucasus region of collective security. Again, that's a Russian formulation. Then nobody else believes there's a region of collective security in the Caucasus. Now, all this is very dangerous because, as we've seen, Nagorno-Karabakh is a tinderbox. And there is a real danger, therefore, of an escalation beyond simply conventional ground forces now to missile forces, and who knows, potentially nuclear threats as well. But it also bespeaks Russia's intention of undermining the sovereignty of every South Caucasus state, isolating NATO from that theater through its A2AD capabilities and these missiles, and expanding the perimeter, just as we talked about at the beginning. So whether or not there was a strategic motivation to build the Iskander, there is a strategic consequence. And those consequences are negative. And they're not only negative in the Baltic. We need to respond in the Baltic, but we need to respond as well with coherent policies and strategies in the whole southern tier, which includes Ukraine, Caucasus, Eastern Mediterranean, and Middle East. Because while we remain in a situation of an incoherent strategy or are reacting too slowly to what Russia has done in Ukraine and has threatened to do elsewhere, and Syria and has threatened to do elsewhere, the fact is that Putin still thinks he's advancing. Tried to make a coup in Montenegro. He's waging information warfare all over the Western world. He is advancing his deployments. Even though they supposedly cut the military budget, that was after they raised it by a huge order of magnitude last year, and they cut it about 7% this year. And those are Russian figures. They may not be absolutely accurate. In other words, as Fiona said, we may not be in a war that's kinetic, except for Ukraine, with Russia, or Syrian rebels in Russia. But we are in a hot war. And the Iskander is one of those instruments that constantly raises the temperature. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. So we're going to go ahead and open the floor to some questions and answers. I just ask you to identify yourself and limit to one question. Okay. So we have the first question in the first row. Sir?
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Chairman, for
being here. And you're before. With
me? Yeah, my name is Harat Chakrashan. I'm the Deputy Chief of Mission of the Armenian Embassy.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you very much for this discussion. I mean, at least it gives opportunity to present our vision, our view on the Iskander missiles issue in our region. As Mr. Blank mentioned, yes, there are. We have recently acquired these missiles from Russia, but there are a few points that I want to emphasize in this remark, very important points. First of all, they are acquired by the government of Armenia. They are deployed on the territory of Armenia, and not on the territory of the Russian military base. And it is the Armenian armed forces that authorized to use this weapon. Secondly, the missiles deployed in Armenia, delivered to Armenia, they are modified, and as correctly said Mr. Blank, so they are tailored for Armenia specifically, with the operational range only for 280 kilometers, and the capability to carry warhead of 500 kilograms. So, and thirdly, it is of course ridiculous to think that these missiles can be aimed at any NATO member countries. It's ridiculous to think that Armenia, a small country, by the way, one of the most closest and active partners of NATO, can target one of the NATO member countries. And finally, it is very important that that we acquired these missiles only as a response to the arms race launched by one of our neighbors. As a result to the as a response to the last year flare up of hostilities, as a result of skyrocketing military budget of Azerbaijan, which is, by the way, is equal to the whole budget, state budget of the Republic of Armenia, and as a result of anti-Armenian hysteria and Armenophobia stirred up by Azerbaijani leadership. And our people believe that these threats poses an existential threat to the Republic of Armenia and the people of Armenia. So we, our ordinary people in Armenia, believe that this weapon is a weapon of containment, is a weapon to counterweight all these military acquisitions made by Azerbaijan, which, by the way, became one of the primary, one of the biggest consumers of Russian-made and Israeli-made armament. So those are the reasons behind acquisition of Iskander missiles by the Republic of Armenia and explain the situation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was there a question you wanted to ask?
No, thank you. I had this remarks.
Response? Or?
I never said that the Armenian missiles are targeted against NATO. The problem is, I don't really believe that Russia has given Armenia the ability to use these things on its own discretion. I mean, I know the Armenian government says so, but it would be the height of irresponsibility, even for Moscow, to allow a third government, in any case, whether it's Armenia or some other government, to have control over these missiles in a conflict situation with no ability by Moscow to check what's going on. I'll give you another parallel for this. If you remember 22, 23 years ago, we had the big issue of Ukrainian missiles stationed in Ukraine that were nuclear weapons, going back to the Cold War. And it was a very difficult effort to get those weapons out of Ukraine because even though the Ukrainian government claimed it had, quote, control over them, it did not. And to any Russian government, whatever its coloration, nuclear weapons in Ukraine under a government that was not the most stable is a potential threat and was destabilizing for everybody involved. So I find it hard to believe that Armenia really can just simply, if it feels threatened, use those missiles without saying anything to anybody. As for Armenia's sense of threat against Azerbaijan, it's paralleled by Azerbaijan's sense, the feeling of being threatened by Armenia. This requires the necessity for both sides and interested third parties to find a solution to the problem rather than engage in arms racing. Because we've seen through the episodes that have taken place that they have the potential to escalate. Even in 93, as you well know, there was the danger that the Turkish military might intervene back then. And at that point, Minister Shaposhnikov of Yeltsin's government said, if you do that, it's World War III.
I prefer that Turkey intervene, right?
No, that was the question. I don't prefer that Turkey intervene. I prefer that both sides come to a solution. I would, whoever helps them mediate it. But I know one thing, Russia is not going to help them mediate a solution. And the answer, I think, is not in getting Iskander missiles, but in finding a solution.
Thank you. Any other, anyone else like to ask a question here from this discussion? If you're not, I'm going to ask a question. So, Pavel, you were talking about the mechanisms to talk to Russia through the INF Treaty. What are those mechanisms that you were talking that? Say they deploy the Iskanders into Kaliningrad and then they suddenly disappear. What is the mechanism that we go through on talking to the Russians?
Thank you for the question. I was talking about the mechanism which is established by INF Treaty. It means that this is a special verification commission and this is a forum for a discussion on those issues between the US and Russia. In the context of INF violation. This is not a specific forum to discuss the issue related to ballistic missiles in Kaliningrad. Just to clarify.
Thank you. Steve, do you agree with the idea of deterrence that Putin is trying to deploy these missiles, as Pavel said, for power projection capabilities? and that there's a lack of understanding about deterrence among Putin's advisors. Is that something you agree with, or how do you perceive deployment, other than an A2AD corridor being created?
Well, I see these in very Russian, Soviet terms. The overall pattern of deployment, not just of the Iskander, but you talked about the A2AD, it's very similar to what we saw in the Middle East in the 60s and 70s, when the Soviet Union gives Egypt all these capabilities so that in 73 they could advance and retake the Sinai from Israel and negate Israeli air superiority. And that worked as a textbook case of using air defense as an umbrella by which through which an army can expand and thus project power. So I do see that as a strategic operation or a series of deployments. As for Putin's advisors, I don't know if Mr. Patrushev or Sechin and so forth are experts in deterrence. I rather doubt it. But I do think the General Staff and the Ministry of Defense are.
Paul, do you agree?
Well, on Mr. Patrushev, I have read nothing from him that would indicate any familiarity with deterrence, though some of his statements really borders to the paranoid. But as far as Ministry of Defense and General Staff, it's remarkable that whom Shoigu brought there to key positions are primarily the warriors, primarily those with real combat experience in the Caucasus, in other places, who do understand a lot of real fighting and have a particular camaraderie of this kind. But they are not really interested in the strategic matters. The deterrence for them is something fairly theoretical. There were times when the General Staff was really leaning heavily in the direction of nuclear deterrence, strategic forces, but presently I see very different General Staff with very different set of priorities, and in fact with a lot of understanding how it happens in the field. What are the real challenges that Russia faces, and probably many of them have second thoughts about the heavy priority in the whole Russian modernization program given to strategic submarines, to nuclear weapons, because they would much rather prefer to have two extra brigades than two extra strategic submarines.
Thank you. Have a question here in the audience.
Boris, yes, I have a question for Pavel, and I apologize if I didn't get what you said. But it seems to me that you said it was possible to solve the ambiguity problem on Iskanders and separate between nuclear and non-nuclear missiles. Concretely, how do you do, and what's the mechanism?
Well, I don't think that the mechanism built into the INF treaty can be really reinvigorated now, because a lot of the real value of that mechanism, when it really worked in the sense of transparency, monitoring, observation, most of that has already expired. It remains a valuable experience, but there is no more. What remains of that mechanism is very slim. My feeling is that the reduction of ambiguity, which probably is needed in this respect, is through a different set of conversations with the Russians, and not necessarily bilateral US-Russian, because the problem is more, but a connected set of conversations, mostly conducted by NATO, with the common platform of how we assess the threat, how we can respond to that, demonstrating to Russians kind of the readiness not to respond in kind, but to strengthen the capabilities which would really effectively neutralize both the threat from Iskanders and from the new missiles which are coming as a violation of the INF treaty. conversations on Kaliningrad specifically, I don't really think that it's possible to have any meaningful conversation on that parameter in the on the parameter of strategic situation in the Southern Front in the Middle East. But nevertheless, there are kind of really themes there where Russia can be engaged, including, for that matter, the very uneasy problem of U.S. nuclear weapons in Turkey, which are there now and probably not really serving much of a useful purpose. Withdrawal of that weapons from Turkey is something which Russia would applaud, which I think that the United States would contemplate as a useful step forward.
Hi, Mike Irosian, former government. Back in the 80s, we had a program called GLICM, Ground Launch Cruise Mobile Missile System. And we were building facilities in Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands to support these ground loss cruise missile systems. And in 1987, as you mentioned, the treaty, everything stopped. And we had a vigorous program to build all these support facilities to accommodate these. The treaty in 1987, we stopped. Should we not consider continuing something like that into the new NATO countries like the Baltic states and Romania and things of that nature to sort of counter Russia's threat with these new their new missile systems?
Yeah, there is a need certainly to think in practical terms about how best to respond, how to strengthen the capabilities that can neutralize this Russian threat, complex as it is, though probably not in a symmetrical way as it was done in the course of the crisis of the 70s and 80s, but much more in terms how to connect the elements of the missile defense which are now being constructed in Poland and in Romania, how to integrate it into a broader system which would also allow for defense against cruise missiles, because that threat at the moment is not really addressed at all. This system cannot do that. Missiles have a very different different capabilities. So engaging the European allies in collective thinking about that, I think, is a very useful way to proceed, particularly because generally that avenue is not non-nuclear. That avenue is not in violation of any international treaties and obligations. I don't foresee much resistance in the new NATO member states, and particularly when you connect that conversation with the conversation which is already happening about increasing of their defense budgets. That signal finally registered in many NATO countries, including Germany, the need to increase, and not just to increase the percentage points, but to increase in the very specific terms their contributions. So not just, okay, we will add another percentage points and that will go to the salary of the officers, but to make a very particular point that we are using the additional investments in order to address that threat, that our steps in this direction, in that direction, in that direction, and how they're coming together.
Paul, if I can add one comment to this conversation. Yes, I fully agree. We have only two options. The one is to find a compromise between US and Russia on the political side, and it seems to me that in the short term it's rather I'm rather skeptic on that. And the another is to start some reflection among the NATO member states on the potential options, including military options and other non-military options. And this is something what we can do, and of course a lot of it depends on the U.S. side, because this is the main player in this game. But we cannot be faced with the challenge that the NATO Europe is could be struck by Russian new medium range missiles.
Thank you.
Steve, do you agree with this gentleman's question about deploying in areas like the Baltic or Romania, the ground launch cruise missile system? Is that understood?
Yeah, are you talking about conventional or nuclear cruise missiles?
Conventional.
Conventional.
I think we had this program.
Yeah, I remember.
It was very aggressive, and we were
the Persians.
Under a lot of pressure to get the work done right. In order to accommodate the Reagan's negotiations in Geneva for this 1987, which finally resulted in the 1987 treaty. Mm-hmm. And once that treaty happened, everything stopped.
Of course.
Look, I mean, right now there is nothing happening with regard to the violation by Russia of the INF Treaty. There's a lot of talk, but there's been no action, neither by Obama, not yet by Trump either. Any action that we do take needs to be taken in a NATO context. It can't be a unilateral U.S. Response. Second, let us be honest that the deployment of GLICKMs or some other kind of missile in Poland, Romania, Baltic states, carries with it a vast enhancement from Moscow's point of view of the imminent threat because of the capabilities and location of those missiles. If you remember very well that the Pershing 2s and the GLICKMs could have hit Russian targets within minutes, and that this was instrumental in bringing about a negotiated settlement between Gorbachev and Reagan. Now, perhaps that Russians would be induced to negotiate a new arms control treaty that would deal with the problem. On the other hand, this needs to be thought out very carefully because it could just simply lead to an intensification of Russian defense spending, particularly with regard to nuclear missiles and so forth, to overwhelm any system, which is a real possibility, or to preemptive strikes, which would bring about exactly what we're trying to prevent. So this needs to be thought out, I would say, with the greatest care and in the greatest secrecy. And I'm not sure that NATO is ready to have this kind of discussion, let alone the Trump administration.
Is not the deployment of the JASSMs in Polish Air Force, isn't that by itself a strategic precision weapon? I mean, designed to go against the Iskanders and others, isn't that?
That's a strategic weapon, but that's not deploying missiles that could target St. Petersburg or major Russian cities and hit them within minutes of any war. Because those bases, if you put them into these countries, are instantly going to become target A. I mean, that's obvious. If I was a Russian planner, I'd want to take out those missiles immediately. And that's why you increase the temptation for preemptive strike precisely to deprive the U.S. or NATO of that capability. So this needs to be thought out. The JASSMs are only designed to take out weapons, not necessarily
strategic command and control as well.
Yeah, strategic command and control, but all the way back in Moscow? I don't think so.
No.
Well, St. Petersburg.
But I'm talking about the Iskander deployment.
Right. But it's one thing to target Kaliningrad or, let's say, Belarus. It's another to target St. Petersburg, Moscow, and so forth.
No, I agree. Yeah. But, I mean, Poland is acquiring the JASSMs.
But as you know, I mean, the Polish government has stated that it wants to have a debate about deploying nuclear weapons in Poland. And, I mean, that for Russia, that they would go ballistic, and the pun is intended.
Well, I mean, there's not even support even in NATO. I mean,
right.
That's
exactly.
Very controversial. You have a question?
I have a question which refers to what we have just spoken about. Because I have an impression that this narration of Russia that it is surrounded by NATO and that NATO is an existential threat to Russia, it is going to continue. It's like their main point of their strategy, and this is how they presented at home to their own public, and this is how they presented abroad to other publics. But we, as members of NATO, we know that we don't have any offensive aim at stake. So as long as we go and agree to this narration, we will always be trapped, because whatever NATO does, they will have to say that, no, we have no offensive aim. So as long as we listen to the Russian narration that NATO is there for offensive aims, then we can do nothing, because we will always be obliged to explain ourselves and to explain why we are trying to increase our defense capabilities, because they're going to call it offense. So my point is that as long as we listen to the narration, we cannot do anything. And you seem to go along the line of their narration.
No. You know, I worked for 27 years for the U.S. military, and we used to have a saying that the enemy always gets a vote. We just can't ignore what the Russians are saying. I don't accept the narrative. NATO is only an existential threat to Russia if Russia is a dictatorship and an imperial state dedicated to revanche in Europe. A democratic Russia and a state that does not have imperial aims against its neighbors, which it does, quite frank, would not see NATO as a threat. And as we all know, up until quite recently, NATO barely had the capability to get to Marseille in Hamburg, let alone get out to Poland or somewhere else. Even now, the balance of forces on the Baltic theater favors Moscow. And NATO, by virtue of it being an alliance of democratic states, is not going to go off and start a war with Russia simply out of the blue. So we don't have to accept that narrative, but we do have two responsibilities. One is to prevent the war from breaking out, and two, to behave in behavior that will lead people to think that NATO is provocative. I don't agree with the argument that there's nothing we can do. We've done a lot in the last 3 years, maybe not enough. I would certainly not say it's enough. But if you go back to 2014, there was nobody in this town who thinking along the lines of what we have to do now. Certainly nobody in Europe thinking along these lines. And as a result, the Ukrainian operation, both in the Crimea and in the Donbas, caught everybody by surprise, though there was ample reason not to be surprised. So the alternatives are not simply ignore the Russian narrative or accept it wholeheartedly, but you do have to take it into account.
No, my point is that maybe we should have also a line of propaganda activities on our own side that would undermine their narrative, because the moment it's undermined, we have more field for...
You cannot create in NATO what you are calling as a line of propaganda, because the minute you say the word propaganda, it will be ruled out. Now, NATO is developing, and I'm sure you're aware of it, maybe not as fast as we would like, information capabilities to unmask, to use the old Soviet term, to unmask and expose Russian information warfare for what it is. Just look at what happened yesterday, you know, in the hearings where we talked about Russian information warfare. There's a whole series of initiatives that are underway here and throughout Europe. It's telling the truth and exposing the lie. It's not propaganda. And we're doing that. Because if we weren't doing that, you wouldn't be hearing the sounds of threat coming out of Moscow. Putin does not, I think, feel that everything is going his way. Some things might be. But they're under a lot of pressure, and they know it. And they're not happy about it.
Yeah, if I have a question over here, and then we'll go to the back.
Yeah. Sorry. My name is Vukar Gurbanov. I'm a counselor at the Azerbaijan Embassy. Thank you very much to Jamestown Foundation for organizing this timely event on European security. Obviously, we are all impacted by the European security. Even so, my country, Azerbaijan, is not part of any security arrangement. No NATO, no CSTO. And we are but a good and reliable partner of NATO. I want to comment on one comment by Dr. Blank about subsidizing Armenia. Since we are not a member of any security arrangement, Azerbaijan, through its own economic resources, acquires weapons from many countries, including from Russia and Israel. So we need to be self-sufficient. But the notion that we are subsidizing Armenia, I think, might not be true, and or is not true. Because if we look back in the 1996, when Azerbaijan didn't have these financial resources, Armenia received $1 billion equipment just for, and those included 32 Scud missiles, and which are, by the way, now located, Armenia stations them in the occupied territories of Azerbaijan, and the statements by Armenia on irreparable damage to Azerbaijan or on hitting critical targets, which, by the way, are owned by international companies, including US ones, are not new ones. We heard it from 97, 2002, they wanted to prevent Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan, they wanted to prevent Baku Tbilisi Erzurum. So it's a long way. So I wanted to present this view. And I also invite my Armenian colleague to be more consistent with their defense officials. Defense officials made it clear that it is Iskander M missiles, which are 500 kilometers. But you are saying 280, so I invite you to sort out with your defense officials, which is true. But being consistent is a good thing. And I'm true or not, but Dr. Blanc said that Armenia doesn't have operational control, but it doesn't prevent Armenia from behaving irresponsibly. From September until now, we heard 11 statements by president, defense minister, deputy defense minister. You know, since Azerbaijan and Caucasus are not part of NATO, they're trying to make this, you know, this irresponsible statements, trying to prevent coming of investment, better cooperation with the Western, with the West. So I leave it to you to comment the true intentions behind it. And last point, my colleague told about hysteria in Azerbaijan, which, by the way, is not true. We are promoting this peace platform. And I invite you to come over to Azerbaijan, as did many of your compatriots. Let's jointly promote peace in the region. Sorry for taking the discussions away from this, but I just...
let's keep it focused on the...
My question. This transfer of Iskanders violates MTCR. And there is some Iskander M missiles, and there is some U.S. sanctions law because of that. Any comments on that? Thank you.
A couple of comments. First of all, let me clarify what I mean by subsidy. I certainly don't think that Azerbaijan is intending to subsidize Armenian weapons purchases. But that's the effect, because you're paying top dollar for the Russian weapons you bought, which is about $4 billion over the last years, whereas Armenia gets these weapons at a reduced price. So that money goes to Russian arms producers who would otherwise not be getting full, quote, full value for their product. So that's why I'm saying that ultimately the consequences that you're subsidizing. As for violating the MTCR, I don't see that anybody has brought that up. That would be grounds, I suspect, for if it's true to impose more penalties on Russia, because Russia is a signatory of the MTCR, it's a member. And this whole situation underscores the danger that inheres in the Caucasus. And it's not just in Nagorno-Karabakh. Let me remind you, the Russian government is now annexing sovereign Georgian territory by incorporating South Ossetia into its gradually into Russia. There's only a handful of states who recognize South Ossetia as independent, quote, or and they're all indebted to Moscow one way or another. So we have here another violation of the Helsinki Agreement and of international law, and the threat of violence or of coercion against Georgia. Then you add the Nagorno-Karabakh situation, which has clearly become more dangerous over the last year because of the increase in the incidence of incidents and of the quality of the weaponry that has been introduced into the theater, and which requires that, since both sides seem unable to negotiate a settlement, that somebody help mediate the situation. Russia will not mediate this. Turkey is will not, anyway, would not be a suitable partner for obvious reasons. But as you know, many of you know, I've written about this extensively. I really think the Trump administration could do everybody a service if it tried to resurrect what Colin Powell did 15 years ago and basically bring the two governments to Camp David or someplace like that and say, it's up to you to negotiate an agreement, and we'll help guarantee it. Moscow will help guarantee it, because they wouldn't be able to reverse an agreement once it's made. But the failure to do anything here leads to the possibility that this could explode into a much broader crisis from which nobody benefits. And I've played those games, so I know. And that's why I think that the transfer of the Iskander, apart from being a potential violation of the MTCR, is strategically among the more irresponsible decisions Moscow has made.
Thank you, Steve. Pavel, short comment?
Yeah, short comment on this MTCR issue. I'm not an expert on MTCR, but there are two specific parameters, and one is the range, and as we have heard from our Albanian colleague, the range of this official range is up to 280 kilometers. It means that this is below 300 kilometers, and probably this means that there is no violation in terms of MTCR range.
Thank you. Young lady in the back, you've been waiting. Thank you.
Steve, when is enough enough? You know, you talk about all these violations. I guess my question is, has NATO come to the point where they're finally willing to recognize the reality of what is going on? It seems to me like they're moving more in the direction. And I think words are important. A couple of years ago, the new Secretary General was in town, and he listed all the various things that that Putin has done to violate this treaty and that. But then he talked about Putin threatening the international order. Well, he's not threatening it. He's destroyed it. And so I understand that it's, if you confront something and call it what it is, then you have to figure out you have to do something. But it seems to be that we incrementally lose because we ignore.
Well, I share your frustration.
Agreement, you know, about bringing people to Camp David. Well, let's remember the Budapest Agreement, too.
Well, I share your frustration, but good policy takes its point of departure from existing realities and then hopefully moves forward, maybe even transcend them. NATO is 28 sovereign states. Two of which are two allies, Poland and Norway among them. I am sure that if we had the foreign ministers of Poland and of Norway, and if we had the foreign minister of Sweden, which is a non-aligned country, we'd get three different views on what the threat to or the actual destruction of international order in Europe, let alone generally, would be. So for NATO to move forward, NATO has to arrive at a consensus amidst itself. Anybody who's dealt with NATO knows this, and it's a very time-consuming and laborious procedure because we're dealing with 28 democracies, all of which have different agendas, have different constituencies, and so on, all of which we know. I'm not satisfied with the level of progress we've made in the last 3 years, and as you know, because we've talked about it, but it would be quixotic to deny what has actually happened. Sentiment today in Europe is nothing like it was 3 years ago. Which is one of the reasons why Mr. Putin is waging an information war against everybody, whether it be Sweden, Norway, Poland, the United States, Denmark, Spain, and so on. So that's already a sign that things have changed. The new defense spending targets, and not just that we're going to raise pensions, but that we're actually going to buy credible capabilities, is also something new. The attempt here to create defense spending that breaks with sequestration, because we cut the budget. You know, even as we're lecturing everybody else, we cut defense spending during this period. That was the law. Now, if sequestration goes away and defense spending goes up and it's used to buy effective military capability, that's another unmistakable sign and will lead other European states to follow. But we need a coherent strategy here, and we need a coherent consensus within NATO. And in the nature of things, that's difficult, regardless of who the president is. This administration makes it harder.
Just a word here on that particular matter. I think one specific issue where more engagement of European allies is necessary is precisely on the INF treaty violation, and why they remain so silent, because United States is not sharing information. What are the violations about? Not just making it public in the media, it is not even shared with the allies. What sort of unity you can expect from that? I think it is essential to move forward on that very particular point.
Pavel. Final question, and we leave it to our staff members from the Hill who are here today.
The Foreign Affairs Committee. I had a question for the gentleman from Sweden and Poland. How would your government view a proposal for the United States to withdraw from the IMF Treaty? Typically, European governments put a greater value on formal treaties than the United States does. So there's the possibility that they would be opposed to this as an option and simply accept Russian violations.
I think from a Swedish perspective, if the US should withdraw from the IMF Treaty, that would cause a rather harsh reaction from Sweden.
From Polish perspective, the most important is, of course, to keep the INF treaty. And if the situation will be very bad, then we can of course, consult this process. I understand that this will be part of the consultation within NATO. And it depends on the arguments which will be provided by US.
That's it. All right, everyone, thank you for coming today. We'll have this posted online with an audio and also a write-up event summary, so look for us.
Yes, only for me.
No,
I don't have a card.
No, I thought you were restrained, so. Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
No, no, no.
Glad. Thank you.
Even worse.
Can we get my phone here?
Hello. How are you?
Thank you.
Start.